Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Geek Town Radio. We've got a slightly different show this week because I happen to be on my own for various reasons. One of those reasons being that we're at MCM Comic Con Birmingham this weekend. So it's just been incredibly busy. We've got a lot of other stuff coming up before the end of the year. I just haven't had time to put a full show together. But we did have a lot of really cool interviews when we were at MCM Comic Con. So I thought I'd put some of those out for you. The first interview we're going to have is with Jason O'Mara. You will know Jason O'Mara from a number of different shows. Most recently, he's been starring as Wyatt in Man in the High Castle. Prior to that, he starred in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. as Jeffrey Mace, aka The Patriot, so you might know him from that. He was in Terra Nova. He was the lead in that show, which was cruelly cancelled too early. He's popped up in The Good Wife. He was in Vegas. He was in the US remake of Life on Mars. He's also the voice of Batman in a number of the animated, later animated shows, or rather the other voice of Batman, the one that isn't Kevin Conroy. So he talks a little bit about doing that, about his work on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., quite a lot about Man in the High Castle as well. So here's the interview with Jason O'Mara. We'll see you afterwards with the next interview.
Well, kicking off with the most obvious question, I guess, are you excited to be here at MCM Comic Con? Looking forward to it.
I'm absolutely thrilled. I've never done a Comic Con in the UK before, even though I lived in London for 8 years and, you know, grew up in Dublin and Ireland. So I've never done a con this side of New York, really. So this is very, very exciting. I get to meet some of the UK fans, some of my UK followers, and actually get to meet them as opposed to just sort of being on a panel or something. Actually shaking hands, pressing the flesh.
And obviously, I mean, Man in the High Castle, season 3 was sensationally game-changing in a whole lot of different ways. Can you talk about, looking back now, what you're most proud of when you look at that particular season and how, particularly for your character, things have evolved?
Well, I'm certainly proud to be playing an Irish character on the show. There aren't that many sort of UK and European characters on the show. A lot of it's sort of concerned with what happens to, you know, America after World War II, when the Germans and the Japanese won the war. So to be able to play an Irish character in particular is something I'm quite proud of. But also, I think just the journey from a situation sort of in the second season where it seemed like the Reich was just rising and rising and rising. Now we have a situation where Juliana and Wyatt and their network are starting to resist, which hopefully will lead in season 4 to something even more proactive and put up some sort of an actual fight. So we have that to look forward to.
You not so long ago started being the voice of the animated Batman, which is obviously like a big legacy of many people before you. How is that in terms of the response to that, and how you go about that in making yourself sort of stand out and compare to such greats that have done it before?
Yeah, it's one of those weird things. I think it's, you're going down a blind alley if you try to set out to stand out from such an amazing array of successful actors who have played the role. So what I tried to do is just figure out what I was going to do and try to do it to the best of my ability. and rely on that really to distinguish me from any other Batman. I suppose that I'm Irish helped, but obviously nobody wants to hear an Irish Batman, or at least that's what he's told. He wants to know. There's one person. I feel like it's something that's evolved over a period of films. So if we look back at Justice League War, which was my first, even though I did some interesting things in it, I feel like I was definitely sort of testing the waters and trying out a few different things. Whereas a few films later, I feel like it started to settle, you know. And even now, I still feel like I'm experimenting with the amount of humanity I'm able to imbue, particularly into Bruce Wayne. I mean, what sets my Batman apart from others is that he's a father, you know, to Damian. And that is something I'm obviously, you know, able to bring as a father myself. Now, my son isn't a teenage mutant assassin, but he can be a bit of a brat sometimes. He's what, 14? And Damian Wayne obviously can be... I mean, now I think we've evolved to a point now where Damian is kind of, his allegiances are pretty clear. But to start out with, you know, he was a loose cannon. So, yeah, I feel like I was able to bring some fatherly qualities to it. And I suppose just my own unique experience as a human being. What's funny also is that I used to play and do voices with my son when he was younger, playing with Batman's voice. I never thought I'd be actually doing it. And getting paid for it.
Was that like an Irish Batman, or was that still like you do it now?
We were both watching the Kevin Conroy Batmans. So Kevin is, you know, hugely influential, I think, anybody who's. And I would never seek to pretend to be replacing Kevin. I'm as well as Kevin, you know, and I think there are so many different, but it's not just me and Kevin either. There are many other Batman voices, both in the animated world and live action, obviously. And I think ultimately that just provides a universe where everybody can find their favorite Batman or their alternative version of Batman. There's just lots to choose from. But I know online early on, I was sort of accused of trying to steal Kevin's mantle, and that's not what I was trying to do at all.
When you start voicing a comic book character, it's a different breed of fan, especially with social media. How do you deal with that, both the positive and the negative? Do you go in and look at the comments on Facebook? Or because there's a lot of talk about Batman and how they portray him.
Yeah.
How do you deal with that?
I've dialed it back a little bit, to be honest. You know, once I saw that comment, like, who the hell is this guy? I was like, wait a second, I don't need to see this because I've got to go in and record tomorrow. I need to feel pretty good about myself. And obviously there's lots of positive comments as well, but it's just, if you believe the good ones, you kind of have to believe the bad ones. And then it's like, are you going to respond just to the good ones? And then if I'm responding to the good ones, then I'm just kind of self-promoting, and that doesn't feel right either. I'm not going to defend myself against people who don't like me because they can just switch it off. So I kind of have dialed back a little bit on social media. I still like to interact with fans, and, you know, I'm an enthusiast. I like to be positive about things, you know, especially about things that make me happy or things I enjoy. I don't really have time for the negativity, and they both go hand in hand, unfortunately, especially on social media. So I've just kind of backed off a little bit, and I'm still there, still have a presence, but I don't go searching, I don't go to comment sections. You know, I don't like go to like hashtag Jason O'Mara, because that's just that's a world of pain. I think ultimately you have to get philosophical about it. You just go, you know, it's different horses for courses. I mean, it's some people are going to love it, which they do, and some people aren't. And it's probably because they've grown up a seminal time in their life when they think of a different voice or whatever. I'm talking particularly about Batman, but it goes for many of the sci-fi stuff. Shows and movies that I've done that people have a very strong opinion about this stuff because it matters to them, and that's okay, you know, and it matters to me too. I don't personally feel the need to tell the world about, you know, what I think about one film or another, about one version or another. I sometimes get upset about certain things like Star Wars movies and things like that. But yeah, I talk about it with my friends. I don't have them on social media. But some people feel the need to do that, and that's okay. I just don't get much out of it, you know, getting that critical and that negative. So I kind of just backed off.
You're one of the few people that's jumped from DC and Marvel.
Oh yeah, yeah.
How was it working?
Forget about that.
How was it working on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and joining, you know, a sort of established cast quite late on into, or a few seasons into it?
Well, first of all, joining Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. was just an amazing experience because of the people involved. You know, yes, it was lovely to get a phone call from Jeff Loeb at Marvel, and you know, he pitched me this idea of Jeffrey Mace, the Patriot, which is, you know, something that we hadn't really seen in Marvel. Well, it was a character that was just generated in the 40s. You know, that was when it first started to appear. And obviously had a very close relationship with Captain America and had various sort of iterations and versions over the decades. But he was someone we hadn't heard from in a long time. And so that was really exciting, the idea of sort of resurrecting a character like that. But also what they did with it, you know, the sort of the double bluff, and that he was kind of a weird guy, untrustworthy, manipulating, lied in order to become a hero. And then that big twist sort of where he gets to become the hero he always wanted to be. And we end up rooting for him. We end up loving him, you know, which is, yeah, if you watch that first episode where he appears, you can't imagine how that's possible. But really what made it special was getting the welcome that I did from Clark and Chloe and Elizabeth and Ian and Henry and everybody there. It was just, I wasn't prepared for that. It completely disarmed me. And I don't know if you've ever met those guys. I know they've been over here a few times, but they're just, they are like a family, you know, and there's just an incredible sense of inclusion. And you really do feel like you're part of it. You're not just a guest, you know. Even though I was very respectful of that it was their set and everything, but it really was brought into the fold and made feel really good about it. So that was an absolute joy. I didn't want it to end, but I'm glad when it did end that I got the death that I feel the character deserved, because it was pretty spectacular. And again, that was, you know, that was sort of, I suppose it ended up being about 7 or 8 months of my life on and off. Whereas with an animated film doing the DC stuff, that's a day every few months, you know, where you go through all your lines, record them, then they'll come back with some animation and you try to maybe match that up, additional dialogue recording, ADR they call it. And then maybe a final session where you need to put in all the fight grunts and groans and literally you're in a room going, you know, all this stuff for about an hour and a half. You can actually lose your voice doing that. It's probably the most challenging part of it, actually. So, yeah, very different experiences, even though one's Marvel and one's DC, they were completely different processes.
Looking to the future, obviously, fans are very excited about what might be in store for us in the next season of Man in the High Castle. Are there areas, both in terms of the characters' relationships and the world that we're exploring, that you would be particularly interested to see the show go into?
Yeah, I mean, there's loads of things I'd be interested in talking to you about, but can say absolutely nothing. But obviously, there's, as I hinted at, I think this idea of resistance becoming something real. I think that's definitely an arc and a trajectory that the show is heading in. I think this idea of traveling from world to world is something that's going to become even more integral. And I love the fact that the show itself is committed to its sci-fi elements. You know, in Philip K. Dick's book, that stuff was hinted at. And then as the television series seasons progressed, it was something that kind of became more and more important. And now it's absolutely integral to it, you know. That's something that's obviously going to be taken into season 4 as well. So these are all elements that are going to be fully explored. And I know what we've done so far is looking really good. I'm really excited.
Talking about integral, I think the really interesting thing about Man in the High Castle is the relationships between the different characters. And I think particularly your relationship with Juliana is quite nuanced and increasingly important, it feels, as the show goes on. I guess, can you talk about your wonderful co-star and why you think that has become a bit of a focal point for the story?
Well, Alex is amazing to work with. She carries that. Yes, Rufus has incredible stuff to play as John Smith, as do all the characters. But I feel like Alexa really carries that show. You know, it's she's the driving force of the story. She works incredibly hard, both before, during, and after the scene, to make Juliana as strong and alive as she can possibly make her. And I was nervous sharing scenes with her initially because she really becomes Juliana on set. You know, she becomes very strong, sort of inside and out. And I wanted to do that justice. And I wanted to be a match for her somehow, you know, even though it's pretty impossible. She's a very special character. But I wanted to somehow, you know, I wanted to bring something new to the party, which I think the writers really did, creating this kind of Humphrey Bogart, kind of Harrison Ford kind of character, you know, which I love playing. But yeah, I think their relationship is, yes, there's some romance and some sexual attraction there, but it's almost becoming this sort of meeting of minds. Now, look, it's no, I appear in season four, so as does Juliana. So I think everybody knows that. So there's going to be something there in the future in season four. Obviously, I don't want to spoil anything, but put it this way, Liam, while it's nom de plume, I suppose you could call it, is his real name. He's holding a torch for her, you know. And so I think his attraction to her goes beyond just something he's interested in terms of a romantic relationship. It's he realizes, as other people who have met her realize, that, you know, she's the key to all of this, and that she represents a cause that is worth pursuing. That's basically their only chance at some version of freedom. You know. Do we have to wrap it up?
I'm excited about that.
This is just getting interesting.
All right.
So that was the interview with Jason O'Mara. I hope you enjoyed that one. The next interview we've got is with Ingrid Allaire, whose name or face you might not recognise, but it was a really interesting interview because she was the actress who played Princess Leia at the end of Rogue One. So we had this little chat with her just talking about the process of doing that and sort of what it was like to be part of the whole Star Wars experience. We had a lovely chat with her. She was really, really nice. And she talks about the process it took to bring that to screen. So here's the interview with Ingrid. We'll see you afterwards for the next interview.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, my name is Ingrid Allaire.
It is lovely to have you here for MCM. Have you been enjoying being part of the Comic-Con?
Definitely. It's been a wonderful experience so far. It's my first time in Birmingham, first time with MCM, and I'm very glad to be here.
And of course, one of the reasons you're here is because you have a small but very unique part in one of the biggest film franchises of all time. Can you talk a little bit about how that journey started for you?
Sure, yeah. Well, I never thought I would be in such a huge and beloved universe as Star Wars is. And on top of that, playing such an iconic character as Princess Leia. So it all started with a very anonymous casting call, a very secretive casting call in London. And then it led to three rounds of auditions. And in the end, they cast me, which I still can't believe. But I'm very grateful.
Obviously, for a traditional casting, they're looking for you as a performer and your look and all these kind of things. I'm curious, given the specific nature of the effects that were going on for this appearance, can you talk a little bit about what they said they were looking for and what you think made you the right fit for the role in the literal sense?
Yes. Well, I was lucky in the sense that me and Carrie Fisher are very similar in height and build. So that was something that had to be there, sort of the first hurdle. And then it was a matter of being able to mimic her facial expressions in a believable way. And I prepared by watching the old Star Wars films on repeat for a whole weekend again and again, paying special attention to her facial expressions, stopping, looking at myself in the mirror, looking again. So it was a very minute, detailed process and very different from how I normally prepare for a role. So, but very, very interesting as well.
And as someone who has literally studied Carrie Fisher's facial expressions, can you talk about the things that you discovered doing that in terms of her unique mannerisms as a performer?
Well, it was also a discovery in general of how each person has sort of a fingerprint or a signature way of moving their muscles in their face and also body posture, where they keep their weight, point of gravity. So it was, I don't know, it's hard to, I'm trying to think now if there's anything particular she did. I remember there was something about how she flicked her eyes, like in that scene where she meets Vader for the first time, like right after where in the very beginning of A New Hope, and she meets Vader in the hallway and this little interrogation scene. And I remember I saw it again and again, and like how she flickers her eyes when she talks about how annoyed the Imperial Senate will be or something. Right. And yeah, it's like it's all there, this information, but we don't really have the time to process it. So it was interesting to slow down the time and really take a proper look.
I think obviously it's such a beautiful moment that ties together the new films and the old films.
Yes.
How does it feel to you, now knowing that you're at that connection point between you know, Rogue One and this new world of adventures we're having and these classic films that mean so much to so many people?
Well, it's a huge honor and also a huge responsibility. I was very nervous about how fans would react to bringing Princess Leia back and tying together the old and the new, and Rogue One being sort of a more experimental standalone piece, but still very close to the trilogy in terms of the spirit, the grittiness. So yeah, it was overwhelming in a way to stand in between those two, the old and the new. But I just had to trust that Lucasfilm and Disney had made the right decision and that I was doing my job well, and that it's sort of out of my hands.
And just in terms of the actual techniques that were used, obviously I think audiences look at the screen and just think, oh, they've done it with computers. Mm. Can you talk about what the actual exact process was for you in terms of how much of your face you were actually seeing versus how much is CGI, and whether or not you were marked up with little dots or if it was just a normal performance?
Yeah, well, it started with the sort of technical prep in LA in San Francisco. So they did sort of it's called the light stage, where you put in a globe of light and they take pictures like 360 and make a digital model of you. So that's what they did with me and Guy Henry. And then I had to hold still and have sort of the basic human facial expressions, like smiling or sad or frowning or crying. And then I also looked at specific facial expressions on Carrie Fisher's face and tried to copy them as well while doing the light stage. And then the brilliant people at ILM worked on my face, I think, for 6 months or maybe more. And then for the shoot itself in London, it was more of a regular shoot, at least for me, except that there were more cameras on set, so there were fewer points where you could look at without like looking into the lens. So you had to be a bit careful. And of course, you had I had the dots on my face, so I looked a bit like an exotic fish or that I had some kind of strange disease. So people had a bit of trouble focusing on my eyes, I remember, when talking to them. But for me, it was pretty straightforward in terms of the performance on the day, which was great to have that freedom.
I mean, obviously, it's very exciting for fans to see these cameos and, you know, the gifts that technology is now giving us. I guess I'm curious, as an actor yourself, how you feel about the broader issue of, particularly as this technology improves and becomes more fluid and more easy, the ethics of kind of portraying other people and, you know, the extent to which using other people's likeness and bringing characters back or making characters look like younger versions of themselves. I guess, how do you feel about that as a wider issue and how it changes the notion of what it means to be an actor?
Yes, it's a very interesting question and thought-provoking development, which is happening very rapidly. And I am quite sure we will see a lot more of this in the future because it gives more freedom for the filmmakers that they can have these virtual people on file and they don't have to pay them as much and they don't need a trailer and so on. And also it can create more fantastical expressions on screen that can be more interesting to watch and so on. But for the actor, it becomes a bit of a dilemma because you're sort of, you don't know what your image will be used for and in what context, like giving away your rights and also the ethics of bringing people back. Like I remember there was a commercial with Audrey Hepburn for the Cadbury chocolate, I think, and one with Bruce Lee for some beer or something, which I read he didn't drink or he would definitely not have approved of supporting this brand of whiskey or whatever it was. So it's difficult, but it's kind of inevitable. And I guess the sooner they have figured out the ethics of this, the better, so we don't walk into this and sort of regret it later. So it has to be done with care. But I think I'm all for new innovations within technology. So I think it's a great tool, but it's how we use the tool that matters.
I guess very specifically for you, having been a part of that process of bringing Carrie back, albeit for that very brief moment, I'm curious if in the future you have the opportunity to do the same in subsequent Star Wars films and spin-offs and prequels and sequels, because it seems we're never going to stop getting those. Would you be happy to go back and do that again and be part of helping to do that for a second time?
Yeah, I think it would be wonderful and a huge challenge. For me, it depends on how the family of Carrie Fisher feel, like how they feel about it. But if they are okay with it and if it's done in a respectful way, then yes, it's kind of an offer you can't refuse, really. But it would be really, really scary. But I'd still say yes. Yeah.
Is there anything else you've already said yes to? I guess my final question, now, what else have you got coming up at the moment you should be excited about?
Well, right now I'm working on a strange project. It's part web series, part feature film, and it's called Out of Place Artifact. It's a Belgian-Brazilian film, and I play an assassin who works for sort of a Viking-esque secret order, and it takes place all over the world. And it's going to be a strange tale, but I'm very excited. So I'm off to shoot in Norway in the snow with some Vikings in early December, and yeah, it should be a fun project.
Well, wrap up warm, good luck with the Vikings. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you very much.
So that was the interview with Ingrid. Hope you enjoyed that one. The last interview we've got this week is with the legendary David Morrissey. You know David Morrissey from a million different shows. Most notably, you'll probably know him from The Walking Dead, where he played the governor. He's been starring in the Sky Atlantic series Britannia most recently. He's was in The City in the City this year. He's was in The Missing, Extent, State of Play. He also starred as Gordon Brown in The Deal as well, which we chat a little bit about in the interview. So mainly we're talking about his work on Britannia and on The Walking Dead, though. So hope you enjoy this. Here's the interview with David Morrissey.
I guess kicking off with the obvious one, have you been enjoying yourself at Comic-Con? Do you enjoy the events?
Yeah, I have this morning. It's nice because I just came off from London this morning and I've been at the table all morning. I've just done a Q&A and I really like, you know, I like meeting the fans. I like that thing of getting their questions and talking to them about the shows I've done, and that's the really great pleasure for me, is meeting all the fans.
And someone who's been part of so many fantastic franchises, film shows, what are the most comfortable most common questions that people are firing at you when they get a chance to meet you?
Well, the questions are very varied. I mean, sometimes it's about character arcs in the show. Sometimes there are technical questions about how the show works. Sometimes there are fantasy questions about who would you like to play in the show if you didn't play yourself, things like that. They ask me about the show now, even though I'm not in it anymore. They ask me about what I feel about the trajectory of the characters that's been happening in our storytelling. Also, sometimes it's about the logistics of the show, you know, how it's put together. So all sorts of questions I get. Sometimes I get questions about how I feel Liverpool are going to do this season. Yeah, you know, all that. So, you know, I get lots of different questions. But I'm always amazed by the questions concerning the shows like Britannia, Walking Dead, Doctor Who, about people's opinion about the development of the script and the character and where the show should be going and where they feel, you know, they'd like to see it develop and where they've loved doing it and stuff like that. So, you know, the fans of these big franchises like Doctor Who, Walking Dead, Britannia, they take ownership of the show. You know, they really care. And I love that. I love meeting people and chatting to them about their passion for the project.
On the subject of The Walking Dead, they've just announced that they're going to start doing spin-off films now. Would you be interested in doing a prequel showing how Governor came about?
I've been asked that a lot. I love my experience on The Walking Dead. I mean, it was a show I'd love to go back to in any capacity. You know, I've often said I'd make the tea for them if they asked me. because it was a wonderful experience. And it's a show made by fantastic people, really talented people. And, you know, you want to work with those people. I love the character. I feel like, you know, the character's got more to give. And I think that's why the show gets actors, good actors in it, because they give you a backstory. They give you real things to play. And it is a survivalist show, but it's something about the human relationships inside the show that really click into people, I think. And I would go back in a shot. And also, you know, I have to say that Andrew Lincoln is an actor who I admire, both as a man and an actor, so, you know, to do anything with him would be a pure pleasure.
I mean, you obviously care about the character just as much as the fans do. I'm curious, what is it when you say you love the character, what is it you love most about?
I like his complexity. I think there's a whole sense of the Governor where he's not just out and out evil. He has his moments where he has this red mist that comes over him. But he does have a conscience. I think the whole thing with his daughter is about him being a good father. He does have humanity. It's very warped because the world is warped. But, you know, I can see the inner struggle, particularly in season four, the inner struggle inside him to where he morally sits. You know, he is fighting the dark side in him a lot, particularly in season four. And, you know, that's a battle that I think we all have in microcosm sometimes, but we all have it that we go, who do I listen to today? Do I listen to the good angel or the bad angel? And he has that. And I love that complexity of him. And his capacity for love, and then his capacity for courage. And then I get to do lots of cool stuff.
Jumping on this, really, the question about would you go back to filming? I'm assuming you're aware that there's a number of novels that my daughter's just read, The Rise of the Governor and things like that, which seem, and because it was co-written by Robert Kirkman, it seems that it's already written there if it needs to be turned into a film. Is that something that has been discussed?
Well, the great thing about Jay and Robert's novels is that's where I took a lot of the characterization for my Governor. There's the comic strip, but I went to the books and I read the books. And we did use some of the story stuff from those books in the season. You know, the whole thing about Brian and Philip and the whole thing about with the family that he rediscovers in season four, that's from those books. But I think they're wonderful. I know, I'd love to do that. You know, I would. As I say, you know, I love the world. I love the genre. I love the character. So, you know, if the powers that be deemed it right to do it, then, you know, I would love to. I think it's, sometimes you walk away from a job and you think, I'll finish with that character. Whereas the Governor, I don't feel that. I think there's a lot more to mine, right? But I think possibly every actor that's been on The Walking Dead could say the same, because they write so well for you. You know, they give you fully rounded characters. There's no one coming in, as far as I can see, coming in and just, you know, giving a few lines. There's people coming in and they have really good storylines to play.
One of the new projects you've got.
So the project I just finished about 2 days ago was Britannia season two.
Okay.
And again, you know, written by Jez Butterworth and Tom Butterworth. And it's, we take it on to another level this time. You know, it's second season. My character Aulis is now deeply embedded in Britannia. He's building cities and roads and all the things that, you know, the Romans gave us. And, you know, he has another agenda, and that is totally to find Kate and use the druids. And the druids are in slight disarray. There's different factions emerging in the druids, and Aulis is able to exploit that in his relationships with different factions. And he's quite a wily person, I think. But his desire for this search for this spirituality and this underworld that the druids have this amazing capacity to live in a spiritual way, and sometimes a very dark spiritual way. And I think Jez, you know, what I love about his writing, when, you know, he wrote plays like Jerusalem, he's really interested in that pre-Christian existence that we have, and how we as a nation worked before the onset of that Roman Christianity that was brought to us. And I love that, particularly because in that we see tribes and people having a respect for the land and for, like, any sort of indigenous people had, really. They had a real spiritual connection with the land around their environment, and how they used it and honoured it. And I think we, as, you know, in our 21st century, we're slightly lost. Well, definitely lost.
Yeah.
So it's about, I love the fact that Jez explores that as well.
And it sounds like it's a bigger world that we're moving into in the second season. I'm curious, are there new characters and new areas?
Yeah, there's lots of new characters. And there's new areas in the sense that he explores Kate, who is the main focus of everybody's attention. She's growing up, you know, she's getting to a place where she becomes maximum danger for us. So we explore that, and we explore the fact that he's having to be the ultimate politician. The new characters are people like Emperor Claudius comes to Britain, played brilliantly by Steve Pemberton, who was a mate of mine. And, you know, there's a power struggle there. So suddenly Aulis, having been top dog, he has to play second in command, or not even third in command sometimes. He's not good at that. And, you know, there's a confrontation between them. And it's a very dangerous place for Aulis to inhabit. And how he negotiates that in a very, I would say, recognisable political way in the way we see our politicians now is very interesting. So, yeah, there's lots of that.
Another project you've been working on recently was The Good Omens. That's another show within a phenomenal cast. How is it just being involved with that?
Well, I'm a huge fan of Neil Gaiman. You know, I just think he's a bit of a genius, really. So when that was muted, I just jumped on it and said, yes, you know, I play Captain Vincent. And it's, it's not a big, huge role. It was a day's work for me. But I love being involved with it. I didn't, unfortunately, get to work with David or Michael, two actors I admire and have worked with in the past. But, you know, it was great to do. And just such a blast to be involved with it, actually. You know, I think it's such a great book. And, you know, and Neil's writing is something that I think is really, you can lose yourself in such a wonderful way. So, yes, I was jacked to be a part of it, but I haven't seen any of it yet, so who knows.
And you mentioned working with Michael there, which is because you worked with the deal. The Crown, of course, is running from the same guy on Netflix at the moment. Eventually, they're probably going to get a point to needing Gordon Brown again.
Well, yeah.
Would you be interested in reprising the role?
I'd be surprised if Peter went there.
Right.
I think he's sort of, he's really covered that. And it'd be interesting what he does with Diana as well, because obviously that's something he's explored as well. So it would, you know, I think the next season goes up to through the 70s.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting to see what he does 80s, 90s. Really. I saw Olivia Colman the other day, and she's really enjoying being in it. So I'm looking forward to it. It was a TV show I thought I'd hate. I came to it, I thought, I'm not going to like this. And I loved it. I thought it was a really wonderful piece. So I'm looking forward to the new cast as well.
Yeah.
And Tobias Menzies as Philip, who, again, as an actor, I love. And Helena Bonham Carter, who's just, you know, we all know how wonderful she is. So really looking forward to those people taking on those roles.
I loved you in One Summer. It's one of the first things I remembered on Channel 4. It still sort of sticks with me today. It's a very powerful thing. You seem to be an actor who's been very fortunate, very lucky. All killers, no fillers. Are you at a point now where you are able to be more choosy, where you say, I'd love to work on Good Omens, I'd love to work on Britannia, yes, please, and therefore are you able to say no to certain things?
Yes, I am, luckily. I mean, I am lucky, and I do think that what I've tried to do in my career is build choice so that I can have different roles. I also work in the theatre as well as TV and film and stuff like that. I do a lot, you know, radio and voiceovers and stuff. So it is very challenging for me. You know, I like to be challenged. So the different roles that come, I often think, have I done this before? What's he going to ask of me? You know,
what's something you haven't done then that you'd still want to scratch? You're too young to play Lear at the moment. But
yeah,
I believe your Julius Caesar was very good.
I love doing that. Yeah, I played Mark Antony and Julius Caesar. I recently saw Antony and Cleopatra at the National with Ralph Fiennes.
Were they doing all right?
They were great. So I think I'd like to play Antony and Antony and Cleopatra. But I think there's those big Shakespearean roles, Benedict and stuff. And there's a lot of Chekhov I'd like to do. I've never done Chekhov professionally. So, yeah, those things. But also, I like to put myself in the way of surprise. So, you know, I like to... Britannia is a perfect example. I was sitting at home. Jez phoned me up and said, look, I just got onto this job. I don't know what it's going to be, but I promise you it'll be fun. And I said, okay. Because I wanted to work with him. I didn't know anything about the character. I didn't know anything about the script, really. I knew the world, and I knew what their ambition for it. All I knew was this was a great, great writer whose work I'd seen in the theatre and admired and been excited about. I mean, Jerusalem I saw several times. And so, you know, when he comes knocking, you go, okay, I'm going to jump. And I think that's the thing. I think that you can't be cautious as an actor. You have to be brave. You have to jump in and really, who knows what will happen. And in a way, I don't care that much. How it turns out is sort of the least interesting thing for me. It's more about the adventure of going on it. It's about working with great people and working together with them. Once they take it off and do what they want to do, that's up to them. And that, for me, is sort of the least interesting thing, because I'm on it on a day-to-day basis, and that's the bit I like. So, you know, when I go to screenings of stuff, I think it's great, but it sort of has nothing to do with me. It seems to have less to do with me than I want it to do. Whereas the great thing about theatre is, even in its execution, it's still got something to do with you because you're doing it right there.
Yeah.
Right there. That's the thing. So, I mean, I like to challenge myself and mess it up and do that. And also, you know, I like to, sometimes you choose jobs for different reasons. I like to see the world. You know, so sometimes they say, look, shooting in the Bahamas, I'll do it.
I mean, I think we might have to let you go quite soon.
Okay.
Just a final question. I think you talked about iconic roles there, and I think obviously in the modern canon, the role of the Doctor is very much one of those.
Yes.
I'm curious, as an actor who at least superficially felt to have come very close to taking the role, how you feel about our current Doctor and the obviously significant change that represented, and if there was ever a possibility you were going to take the role?
There was never a possibility that I was going to. It was a slight curveball that came to me because I filmed the Christmas special and we filmed it in February. It was called The Next Doctor, and I was playing a man who thought he was the next Doctor. Just after we'd shot the episode, David Tennant announced he was going to leave, so then this rumour mill happened. And Russell asked me to sort of not say that it wasn't. And I said, okay. And then I said, but I can tell my kids. And he went, no, come and take it. They'll tell someone in their playground, and then I'll go. And I thought, okay, so I won't tell anybody. So, you know, for about 6 months, nobody knew that I wasn't going to be here. But I think Jodie's fantastic, and I think it's about time. And I think she brings a real different dynamic to it, but I think she's got everything the Doctor needs. I think, you know, what happens when anybody takes over from the Doctor, it happens to Peter and Matt and, you know, David to a certain extent, is that people say, it's not as good as the last one. And it takes time. It takes time for that new vision. And obviously with Jodie, there's other people as well, because behind the scenes, there's new writers and showrunners and stuff. That'll take time, but I'm really enjoying it. So, you know, I think it's going to be a really exceptional piece of work as it goes on. But they all, every new Doctor has this time where people are a bit like, no, I'm not sure.
So we'll see you in Britannia. Thank you so much.
Yeah, great. Thank you very much. Thanks for all the questions.
So that was the interview with David Morrissey. Hope you enjoyed that one. We should be back to a normal-ish show next week, although we are heading into December, so that means...
The Geek Town Awards.
from the 1st of December, the Geektown Awards will be back live on the website. We've got another big prize for you again this year. We will be doing something relating to the Geektown Awards on the podcast. Usually we do it slightly beforehand, but because of the way Comic-Con fell this year, it meant that I've had to jiggle things around a bit. So we'll probably launch it on the website first and then we'll do a podcast for it. But keep an eye on the website from the 1st of December. You'll be able to go on and vote for your favourite TV shows, movies, video games and stuff throughout the year and be in with a chance to win a huge prize. So we're 1st of December on the website for that. Keep an eye out. I'll just do a couple of quick air dates for you as there isn't much starting next week. There's only three shows. You've got Kidding, the new Jim Carrey show. That's a comedy drama about a children's TV presenter who is going a little bit stir crazy. That starts in Sky Atlantic on the 29th of November. You've got Vikings, which comes back for second half of season 5 to Amazon Prime. That's on the 29th of November as well. And F is for Family season 3. That's coming onto Netflix on the 30th of November. So that's your lot for this week. As ever, if you want to find out any more information throughout the week, you can go to geektown.co.uk and get all the latest air date information. If you want to get in touch with your questions and comments, you can email us on podcast@geektown.co.uk. Leave a message on the website post. Find us at Geektown on Twitter, on Facebook at facebook.com/Geektown, on YouTube at youtube.com/Geektown. There are a lot of interviews going up on there this week, or up on there now, actually, including video versions of the interviews you've just heard. So if you want to see them as well, you can go and find them on YouTube. And also Instagram at Geektown UK. Lots and lots of cosplay photos going up on there. So if you're a fan of cosplay, go and check out Geektown UK on Instagram. You can also find us on Spotify, where you just need to search for Geektown Radio. You'll find the podcast on Spotify. That's everything. We shall see you next week. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.